Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker, speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, April 24th, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with colleagues in the print and digital media. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from WCAI's Sam Houghton and Eve Zuckoff. We'll speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Alex Darris at the Provincetown Banner. We'll check in with Ethan Genter at the Cape Cod Times, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We'll hear from Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette and from Mike Dean up at the State House. And we'll finish off by speaking with WCAI's Jeanette Barnes. WCAI Sam Houghton starts us off in these busy times with an overview of the latest numbers and information on the local coronavirus response. Hiya, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
Sam, let's start off by talking numbers and bring us up to date on where we are right now.
Yeah. Another sad number reached this week. 2,000 Massachusetts residents now died from virus. That's since March. That's double the number of fatalities since just last week. There are now 46,000 residents that have tested positive in total. Locally, there are just about 700 cases on the Cape. That's only 150 more than where we were last Friday. There are just over 2,000 cases in Bristol County, up about 1,600 from last week. Just a few more cases on Martha's Vineyard. There are just 16 there. And Nantucket, another 20 straight days without a confirmed case. Some good news there. Also, it's important to say the state is in a surge of patients right now. The numbers do kind of fluctuate day to day in terms of daily testing, but overall, the trend is still going up statewide.
Sam, that being said, a lot of towns have elections next month, and there's a special election to fill a vacant seat for the Plymouth and Barnstable districts in the state Senate. You spoke to some people about this week. Are we going to have this election on May 19th?
Yeah, as of now, yes. I spoke with Michael Palmer. He's the town clerk in Falmouth. He says they're urging people to vote by mail, and earlier the better for that election. But he has concerns about having enough poll workers. A lot of volunteers and people that help on election day are older and might not want to leave their homes. Palmer says that if there's still a surge in patients in the state, he may ask to postpone the election. That would be the second time for this special election because of the pandemic. But he says he'll know a lot more in the coming weeks. And, you know, I think that's a sentiment we all share. When is the surge going to peak and start to slow down?
Also this week, we've seen a lot more testing throughout the state. Tell us about this.
Yeah, actually, this morning we learned there was a huge spike in tests taken yesterday. I'm not talking about confirmed cases, but actual tests taken. Normally, we see about 5,000 tests in a day, but yesterday afternoon, the state reported there was well over 14,000 taken. Baker said the key to reopening the state is having ample testing, and I think we're starting to see that. The governor also announced that Partners in Health, they're a Boston nonprofit, would be working with community health centers around the state to help with testing and tracking cases. We learned this morning that the Outer Cape Health Services, that's a community health center in the Outer Cape, they'll help in that effort. But basically, they're getting in touch with patients that have tested positive, making sure they're okay, and they may have gotten contact with carrying the virus. That's going to happen around the seen us in countries like Germany, but some are reporting this is kind of the first of its kind in the country. And the idea really is to contain the virus and stop community spread.
That is WCAI Sam Houghton speaking to us about contact tracing there. At the end, you were breaking up a bit. Sam, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
Wednesday marked the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. And the COVID-19 pandemic did its number on this, too, forcing cancellations of marches, rallies, and other events. But still, some local actions did take place. WCAI's environmental reporter Eve Zuckoff joins us for an update. Hi, Eve.
Hi there, Steve.
Eve, Earth Day has long been celebrated by people coming together with nature and each other. So how do people in the region observe the anniversary without gathering?
Yeah, like many things, social distancing made it really hard. But the theme this year was climate action. So action was the goal. Both the Center for Coastal Studies in Provincetown and the Vineyard Conservation Society asked people to just get out, go to their local environment, clean up a beach, a trail, a road, a riverbed, you name it. Get out there, take some pictures of yourself, wear all the protective equipment. And actually, the Vineyard Conservation Society is encouraging people to do this all month. And then for those who couldn't get out and do that kind of cleaning, actually, former WCAI host Heather Goldstone said, stick your head out a window. If that's all you can do, just try to reconnect with nature somehow.
The state also seized on the momentum of the 50th anniversary and announced that it was ramping up its 10 and 30-year plans to address climate change and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. What is the plan there?
Yeah, so in January, Governor Charlie Baker announced Massachusetts would reduce its greenhouse gas emissions to net zero by 2050. That's, you know, balancing how much carbon we put into the atmosphere by how much we take out. And that moves us far beyond existing state requirements to reach an 80% reduction by 2050. But, you know, on Earth Day, the Baker administration, they formalized that goal. They put it into law, making us only the third state to legally set that net zero standard by mid-century. So that's a pretty big deal. And then within that announcement, the administration said it was also setting more aggressive emissions limit for the year 2030. So to get that interim, that benchmark, to know that we're really on the way. So it's an exciting time to see how the state will reach its goals and actually commit to not just reducing fossil fuels, but actually pulling carbon out of the atmosphere. We've got a long way until 2050, but there's a lot of work to do.
Eve, I know you spoke with a lot of local leaders about the 50th anniversary of Earth Day landing in the middle of this pandemic crisis. Tell us, how are they reflecting on that timing?
Yeah, I think there are really three points that they brought up that work together that are a little bleak, but also hopeful. And the first is that we need to really look hard at this pandemic and realize that for a long time, scientists have been warning us that it was a possibility. It seemed inconceivable, but now we're living it. And that same thing might apply to other science. So when scientists tell us how bad climate impacts could be, and it seems unimaginable, that doesn't mean it's impossible. We really need to think about that. But at the same time, in the face of a global pandemic, we've mounted a swift, dramatic, science-first response, and it proves that we can influence the trajectory of really huge and really scary global events. So ultimately, people should draw some inspiration from the accomplishments of the global environmental movement over the last five decades as they face the challenges ahead.
That is WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
On Martha's Vineyard, as in many places this past week or so, a number of people gathered to call for reopening businesses. The size of the crowd itself was relatively small, but the discussion around it was big and kind of loud. George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us to tell us more about it. Hi, George.
Good morning, Steve.
George, this started with a call for a rally that was posted on Facebook.
That's right. It was posted by Jamie Douglas, whose family owns the Black Dog franchise, the restaurants, the T-shirt shops, the tavern. And almost immediately, there was a backlash online on Facebook with people saying, you know, that this shouldn't happen. And one person in particular started a website, Boycott the Black Dog. It spiraled pretty quickly. People on both sides, you know, this has been a hot issue all over the place, Michigan, Ohio, even on the Cape at the Bourne Rotary, people saying that we should open back up for business and not live in fear, as they say. And so hotly debated, of course. When we reached out to the Douglas family, they said they were pulling out of this, that that it had gotten out of control and really wasn't the message that they were trying to put forward. They sat down with our reporter, Brian Dowd, and tried to explain that, you know, while they wanted to reopen, they were really wanted to start a dialogue, which you could say they did, but not maybe in the way they intended. You know, as you pointed out in our email exchange ahead of this, the comments section of our paper and also the Facebook page, people are really upset about this. Although there is some support as well. You know, there are people who say it is time to open up safely. The Vineyard to this point, go ahead.
Well, they did actually. So then on Wednesday, there was, I don't know if rally is too strong a word, a gathering, a public gathering of folks calling for a reopening. Is that right?
Right. So there were a few people who said, hey, this was never about the Black Dog. It was about people who are like-minded and wanting to reopen the island. So about 10 people gathered at the time where this original rally had been set for, the Freedom and Liberty to Work rally. And they held signs saying things like all jobs are essential and waved the flag and stood out there for a couple of hours and generated some attention back and forth. And, you know, then it was over. And, you know, we should point out that there is a little bit of opening up of the island that is going to happen starting on Monday, where 1- and 2-person crews are going to be allowed to go back to construction job sites. And folks like landscapers who only work by themselves are also going to be allowed to head back out. They're going to have to follow some safety protocols put in place by the Board of Health.
Well, the energy behind this discussion really is about economics and for a lot of people in terms of going back to work. And on one side, it's the other side, it's a health discussion. You have an article this week also about looking towards summer and what the impact on this could be on the summer. To round up a little bit of that for us.
Yeah, so we all know that the summer is such a huge thing on the island. It's really the economic engine of Martha's Vineyard. Lots of people come to the island, either seasonal residents or day trippers or people who rent other people's houses. And so we wanted to look into that a little bit. I started to get some inquiries and talked to a couple of people who had made deposits, and they're wondering, should I make that next payment? Is anything going to be open? Is it going to be worth it? Are we going to be welcome to the island? And I'd like to tell you that I was able to get answers for them, but the answer is simply that things are still way too much up in the air about all of that. Everybody's sort of looking to that May 4th date. What's going to happen then? And that's the date that the governor of Massachusetts has set as the day for his stay-at-home advisory and non-essential businesses to remain closed. So what's going to happen after that point? You know, the people I spoke to said they're getting responses, but they're not really getting answers. So it is a really something that's so in flux right now. And I know, speaking for myself and the newspaper, we're hopeful that there'll be some season because we're a business there too, and other businesses, we rely on other businesses to advertise in our publication, and we want to see somewhat of a vibrant season. I think the thing that's clear from speaking to the Chamber of Commerce is while they're also hopeful that there'll be a summer season, that this is going to be a different experience this year, no matter what, to what people have had in the past on Martha's Vineyard. There aren't going to be huge gatherings. A lot of events have been canceled at this point, but people are looking for other ways to do their events. Like the film festival, for example, is looking at maybe a drive-in. So, you know, there's still hope, but it's going to be different.
That is George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Steve, and stay well.
This is the News Roundup on the Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. I'm Steve Junker. For high school seniors, this year will be memorable, but probably not in the way they hoped. So some community members have joined a campaign to signal their support. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us now with the story. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Steve.
Tim, there's a lot of things seniors look forward to that they're going to end up missing. This is a nice story about people recognizing that.
Sure. As you said, seniors are going to miss all those end-of-the-year events that we all experienced and have fond memories of. And even graduation right now is up in the air for most school districts. But Julie Santoni, who is a Harwich parent of a Monomoy High senior, saw a Facebook post recently showing a lawn sign recognizing high school seniors from Barnstable High. She thought that was a great idea, so she got in touch with Tim Luce, who runs a Flagmen's sports store in Centerville. He had printed the Barnstable signs and said that he could do them for Monomoy High School as well. So Julie ordered 10 of the signs, which she had intended to give to her daughter's friends to display on their lawns. The signs basically say, this is the home of a Monomoy High School senior, with the logo, the shark, the school's logo, and sort of festive decorations on it. But that initial order of 10 grew, and now they're trying to get enough signs to post them on the lawns of all 123 Monomoy seniors. Even the lunch ladies at the high school who give out the free lunches every day got one of the signs to display at the front of the school to show their spirit and support for the seniors. It's been a real community effort. A lot of people have donated to get signs to make sure that all graduates could have the signs. You know, it's a great boost at a time when many of the students, as you said, Steve, are feeling a bit disappointed about this this school year. It seems to be spreading. Luce told us that he's made signs now for most of the Cape's other high schools, and he said he's heard from others that that are interested in them as well. So look for those signs around town. I think you'll see them popping up soon, if they're not already up.
Tim, you've also got a really cool story in the paper about the Chatham Fire Department MacGyvering a better way to sanitize their ambulances. Tell us about this.
Yeah, well, of course, these days there are heightened protocols for sanitizing things like ambulances. Whenever they go out on a run, when they come back, they have to do some cleanup. You know, think about how complex that is in an ambulance. You know, you're not only talking about stretchers and obvious surfaces that may be touched, but you know, how many small items are in an ambulance, bandages, things that are in compartments. So wiping down all these surfaces is real time consuming and tedious. But thanks to a fire department out in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Chatham firefighters found a quick and simple way to sanitize ambulances between runs. After seeing a YouTube video which showed an improvised aerosol system being used to spray down an ambulance, firefighter Harrison Feitz took on the job of building the device for the department, and a trip to the hardware store and $120 later, and he had assembled a unit which uses a spray painter and a special nozzle and a reservoir with sanitizing solution in it. The device sprays a fine mist over the surface. It dries in under 10 minutes. The unit is portable, so it can be used in other vehicles and other locations as well. And it's a great example of, you know, ingenuity at this this time of need. Chief Peter Connick said it's probably going to become part of the department's usual cleaning procedures now, even after the COVID-19 emergency is over. So yeah, they kind of put this together, and it saves them time and keeps everybody safe.
And you can imagine that them doing it is going to sort of be a boost for other departments too to find out that this is possible.
Yeah, I think they said they've already heard from other departments. The instructions for doing this apparently are being spread pretty far and wide now. It's been in a firefighting magazine, and it all came out of this one fire department in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It takes some initiative to get it together, because it's not an off the shelf thing. Although the items, the elements of it are easy to find, and you just need to have somebody be able to put it together for you.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the Local News Roundup. On the Point, I'm Steve Junker. Event cancellations are popping up everywhere like daffodils in the spring, and Nantucket is no exception. Josh Balling joins us now from the Inquirer and Mirror. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
Not quite as happy as daffodils, I will say, but many cancellations, and that means lost revenue too, right, Josh?
It certainly does, and the cancellations just keep coming in. They actually start this weekend with what would have been the Nantucket Daffodil Festival. The 46th Annual Daffodil Festival was one of the first events obviously canceled due to coronavirus. And on Wednesday night, the Select Board also canceled the annual downtown 4th of July festivities, including the popular Main Street Water Fight that brings thousands of people to downtown Nantucket on the 4th of July. They didn't rule out postponing the 4th of July fireworks.
Josh, do we have you there? Josh, are you back with us now?
I'm back.
Okay, we lost you there for a moment, but you were just telling us about some of the cancellations, if you can pick that up.
Right, 4th of July fireworks may still happen. They've been haven't ruled out being postponed to a later date. Canceling them altogether would mean a loss of about 50% of the cost of putting them on, so the Select Board is trying to find potentially a time later in the season to have those. The Nantucket Cottage Hospital also canceled what is probably the island's largest and most lucrative fundraiser by far, August's Boston Pops concert at Jetty's Beach. They did that on Wednesday as well, and that cancellation joins most, if not all, of the island's annual summer festivals, the Daffodil Festival this weekend, the Book Festival and Film Festival in June, the Garden Festival in July, and numerous other smaller nonprofit fundraisers. So it's going to be a very different summer here on Nantucket, as it is everywhere, of course. But like you mentioned, that's revenue lost in visitors coming to the island, and it's revenue lost to these nonprofits. The hospital fundraiser itself raises annually more than $2 million for operations at the hospital, and they're going to have to find another way to do that, raise that money. They said that they're already working on some kind of a virtual event, and that information on that will be forthcoming. So the concert won't be held on the beach, but there will be some kind of hospital event this summer in an attempt to entertain everybody and make up some of that lost revenue.
And Josh, I have to ask you about the COVID case numbers on the island. The island really is a success story, it seems like, in terms of keeping the virus at bay.
It certainly does seem like a success story, as much of a success story as can be told with the limited number of testing that's going on, obviously. Yes, only 10 cases of coronavirus have been confirmed on Nantucket, and there hasn't been a new case in 20 straight days confirmed on Nantucket. A small number of tests are being performed every day. The hospital is sending up anywhere between 5 and usually 10 at the most tests to state labs for testing, and there hasn't been a positive case in 20 days come back. So there has been some success there, definitely.
That is Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Thanks for joining us, Josh.
Thank you.
A nursing home in Brewster this week reported nearly 60% of its residents tested positive for COVID-19. Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times has that story for us. Hi, Ethan.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. Ethan, nursing homes in the state have been hit hard by this virus. What do we know about what's happened in Brewster and around the region in some of the other facilities here?
Yeah, so on Monday, it came out that after three rounds of testing, 60 of the 92 residents at Pleasant Bay Nursing Home and Rehabilitation Center over in Brewster had tested positive for COVID-19. Out of that, there's been five residents that, according to the town, have refused to take this voluntary testing that was set up by the state. But like you said, nursing homes have been hit very hard. These numbers are slightly out of date at this point, but more than 6,000 residents and healthcare workers and over 250 long-term care centers have tested positive, and they make up more than half of the deaths in the state, people in long-term care facilities.
This is such a vulnerable population, obviously, and the population most at risk here.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're still trying to figure out exactly kind of what the breakdown is. According to the administrator over there, they said many of the cases are asymptomatic, and all the people who did test positive are being isolated and cared for. But yeah, I mean, this is kind of a population, and I mean, Cape Cod in general is a elderly population and is definitely a little bit higher at risk. And I mean, you can look at Brewster's numbers. They had 78 positive cases in total, and 60 of them are from this one single facility.
Mm-hmm. The administrator at the facility also kind of making a point to praise what he called the heroic staff efforts there. And you can imagine the folks working there must be just in such a stressed moment right now, working so hard to try to keep everybody safe and healthy.
Yeah, and the town and Cape Cod Healthcare and the Visiting Nurses Association are trying to make sure that everything is going smoothly over there and staff have the appropriate protective equipment and just trying to make sure that this can be contained and these people can be cared for. But yeah, this has kind of been an issue across the state, or definitely across this vulnerable population.
Do you know about how the state is giving out numbers on all of this? The state has sort of a new dashboard where they're trying to communicate information about nursing home facilities and the numbers there.
Yeah, so this was one of the first publicly put out there numbers inside a nursing home. And then almost, I think, that same day or the next day, the state started to roll out this new dashboard that kind of breaks down further. The feds and the state are kind of pushing out and requiring nursing homes to kind of report what their numbers are looking like. And obviously, I mean, that's a big thing. I mean, if your family member is in a nursing home, you'd want to know kind of what is going on there. Are there any positive cases?
And particularly now, because you can't visit family members in nursing homes in an effort to keep the virus out. I mean, essentially people are isolated within the nursing home. So to know what's happening there is more important than ever, you can imagine.
Yeah, and it's important to point out that the overarching group that owns Pleasant Bay also owns Seashore Point up in Provincetown, and has they've done testing up there as part of this state voluntary testing program. And we haven't heard back from them if they have results for Provincetown yet.
That is Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times joining us today. Thank you, Ethan.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Provincetown is starting a recovery coalition to figure out how to put the town back together after the state quarantine is lifted. From the Provincetown Banner, we are joined now by Alex Darris with the story. Hiya, Alex.
Hi, Steve.
Alex, this has gotten a lot of attention, particularly online. Tell us about what's being proposed here.
Yeah, so I think people are just kind of really interested because it's kind of looking towards the future that we will eventually reopen. This isn't forever. So yeah, town manager Robin Craver, she started this group of about 15 or so people that they plan on taking the next 6 to 8 weeks on just figuring out all kind of aspects of how to reopen from a public health standpoint, and then what the businesses think would be best, and kind of working with all parts of town to make some kind of plan to open, which is particularly going to be interesting since all this is happening right before the summer when Provincetown has so much going on usually.
What is the big hope here, that they'll be able to gradually reopen businesses?
Yeah.
Or restaurants?
It would not be like a light switch. That's kind of what the coalition is planning on figuring out, like the logistics of that. But they're anticipating that this summer, like the tourism department, they're really trying to push a quieter summer where people aren't really, it's not the typical crowds in Provincetown, but enjoying the beaches and the open space, because they're anticipating a huge drop in visitors anyway. So still trying to get people to want to come into town and enjoy the more serene aspects of it that won't put them at risk for whatever, contracting whatever virus or anything.
Kind of like an older image of Provincetown in a way.
Yes, that's definitely their marketing ideas. Less crowds, more the Provincetown that you knew when you were growing up, like from back in the day. So,
Alex, the paper, you guys have a really nice story about the Stop and Shop in town receiving some money for employees to do their own grocery shopping. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so one part-time resident, Eleanor Panisi, she donated $2,000 in gift cards, and she wanted it to go to the most needy people. And after speaking with the store manager and everything, they decided that the associates and cashiers who are working there every single day would be a great set of recipients. And they also had two other donations of $500 asking the same thing. So there were in total last week, $3,000 given to store associates to do their grocery shopping.
And the money came from some people who just were moved to try to support the employees for being there all this time.
Yeah, there's been a lot of different charitable efforts in town, even particularly at the Stop and Shop, where a few weeks ago, someone donated $5,000 for all of those shopping in the early hours, which are meant for seniors, to get their groceries for free. So I feel like folks in town are just really trying to help make things easier when they can on their neighbors during all of this.
That is Alex Darris at the Provincetown Banner. Alex, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. Martha's Vineyard depends on ferry service, and in the midst of this pandemic, the Steamship Authority is grappling with crashing revenue and unforeseen maintenance. Reporter Noah Asmo takes a closer look at that story in the Vineyard Gazette, and he joins us now. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Steve.
Noah, the Steamship Board met this week, and they seemed to be sending a signal that they were getting a handle on the financial challenges here, that things were maybe not quite as dire as they may have seemed last week. Is that right?
Yeah, that was sort of the sense. And maybe the financial situation as it stands right now, I think, is as dire, but it seemed like there were steps taken at least to try and mitigate the blow and deal with it in the short term. Just for a little bit of background and perspective, the Steamship sent a letter last Friday to Governor Baker. It was this totally unprecedented letter asking him for financial aid. Basically, the Steamship, unlike pretty much any other state charter transportation agency, they rely almost entirely from ticket fares for their operations. They don't normally get state funding. So this was a pretty historic request. I don't think they'd ever done something like it in the boat line's modern history, which goes back to about 1960. At the meeting on Tuesday, they took up like a laundry list of measures to try and address the issue.
So this meeting, I just want to throw this out there for people who don't know, this meeting went on for 4 hours, right?
Yes, it went on for 4 hours. And for people who haven't been covering municipal meetings for the past month or so, they all happen over teleconference. And so this was a 4-hour teleconference meeting with the Board of Governors of the Steamship Authority, which is a 5-member body, and Steamship Authority officials. And that is also an unprecedented amount of time. Normally these meetings are long, but they're not total marathons like that. And it was also somewhat of a combative meeting. The Steamship took up a lot of issues that, you know, sort of only peripherally have to deal with the financial crisis at hand. One being the Woods Hole terminal project, another being the situation that's going on with the Oak Bluffs terminal. Really, it's kind of like a crazy sort of, the term perfect storm is probably used too often, but that's sort of what's going on there. And it, you know, culminated in this 4-hour meeting.
Well, you talk about them peripherally having to do with these projects, but these projects cost money. The Woods Hole terminal rebuild is now, the price has escalated over $70 million. Is that right?
That is right. And that was a point of concern for governors. Maura Tierney, who's been a constant outspoken critic of the change orders that the project has necessitated, was even more adamant about them on Tuesday. The thing about it, though, is that actually the Steamship, because of its sort of bizarre, unique financial structure, they can't use any money that goes toward capital projects. So they can receive these bonds, but those cannot go to their operations. So they couldn't just say, hey, we're going to stop the Woods Hole project and use that money to fund the operating deficit. That money actually still has to go to the project. So for them, it's like, well, why not? We might as well continue. We want to be operational by the summer. They're operational now, but we want Woods Hole to be fully operational. So it kind of just is more of an optics issue than one in reality, but it's still such a crazy thing that they're discussing the $70 million Woods Hole project while the boat line itself is in a massive financial crisis.
And it looks like that financial crisis now, part of the handle that they're getting on it has to do with accessing some money from the government, from the federal government, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. They're set to receive about $12 million in state and federal grant money. Most of it's coming from the CARES Act, which is the Coronavirus Relief Act that was passed in Congress. The thing about it is that the Steamship originally thought that money was going to come 6 to 8 weeks from now. It looks like it's going to be here in 3 to 5 weeks. At least that's what officials with the Steamship were saying at the meeting on Tuesday. And that gives them a little bit of wiggle room. In their letter that they sent last Friday asking for aid from Governor Baker, they sort of obliquely said that if they weren't to receive any money, then they would have to cease operations by May 31st. But if the money comes, that was, you know, assuming that they would get the money in 6 to 8 weeks. But if it comes in 3 to 5, then it gives them some space to be able to prepare for that May 31st deadline. And it looks like their plan and the sort of level of confidence they expressed in being able to achieve that plan was higher on Tuesday, knowing that the federal money was going to be coming earlier than was initially expected.
That is Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
Massachusetts has emerged as a hot spot for COVID-19, with the death toll doubling to more than 2,000 in a week. WCAI's Catherine Iden talked with State House reporter Mike Dean for a recap of some of the big news from the governor this week.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good to be with you, Catherine.
One of the reasons Massachusetts might be a hotspot, at least according to Governor Charlie Baker, is that our state is doing more testing than nearly any other state in the country. And the Baker administration announced this week it will send even more tests, places like community health centers in New Bedford, Fall River, Provincetown, and elsewhere.
Yeah, those community health centers is going to be over 7,000 COVID-19 test kits going out to those community health centers. And these are really places that are very well connected with the communities that they're in, kind of essential medical care services in urban areas, densely populated areas. And so when these types of organizations have the capacity and the staffing really to begin to test, it's a step in the right direction for getting to some of the more vulnerable populations in our cities. You know, mentioned Provincetown up there as well, where, you know, you are dealing with kind of underserved communities when it comes to healthcare, which coincides with groups that might be more susceptible to the disease itself, to COVID-19. The reason that Massachusetts has really become a quote-unquote hotspot, at least according to Baker, is because of the rate of testing that we're doing. We're pretty much consistently one of the top three states that is testing per capita. We're doing more testing. So it's not necessarily that we have a higher rate of infection than other places. It's that we have a more accurate idea of our rate of infection because we have more accurate testing data. That it goes hand in hand. So it is a little bit of a chicken and an egg dynamic at play here. That's why, you know, Baker is, you know, not necessarily worried that we are a hotspot, so to say. It's because of the resources that the state has put into getting as much testing out there as possible and getting labs up and running to do it so that we can have this data set that shows the depth of the problem.
Right. Yeah, it's what we've been talking about, I think, the entire time we've been in this pandemic, is the need for more tests so that we can have the real numbers and not just guesswork or numbers that have meaning but certainly don't reflect yet the full scope of the infection rate. Massachusetts was also in the news due to Governor Charlie Baker's announcement that the state would be hiring dozens of people to do some contact tracing. And this testing availability at community health centers will help with this, right?
Yeah, definitely having the community health centers involved in that tracing collaborative that's being organized by Partners in Health, who does a lot of work in developing countries and did a ton of work around the Ebola outbreaks in Africa and other places. They're heading up our tracing effort. So what this is going to be, it's going to be hundreds of people who are taking these COVID-19 results, finding positive patients, and then contacting folks who would have had contact with them. So if your coworker, you know, tests positive and you have been around him in the last couple of weeks, then they would reach out to you and say, oh, this person in your area or this person that you ran into has tested positive, so you need to self-quarantine for 2 weeks. So this is something that the state's working on. They're working with cell phone carriers so that the caller ID, when you get that call, comes up as, you know, Massachusetts COVID tracing or something similar to that, so that you do answer the phone. They're reaching out to cell companies, so it's not just landlines or anything like that. And the governor says, if you get that call, take it seriously, give them all the information they need. So this is kind of building a network through tracing and positive testing that really needs more and more testing to be accurate and be productive.
And the amount of people needed to do the contact tracing, because it really is some kind of old-fashioned detective work, you know, picking up that phone, hoping somebody answers, and then having a human-to-human interaction to get that information, it's kind of an amazing thing.
And it's one of the things that the state's hoping to take advantage of a lot of the folks who are out of work right now. This is, you know, a paying gig, temporary work that folks can sign up for and go to work. And it's unfortunate that, you know, the unemployment spikes have happened that we've seen, but this is an example of the state kind of putting money behind solving the problem while also trying to help out some people who, you know, might be in the labor market right now.
The governor, as we know, also canceled school for the rest of the academic year. And when he did that, he said he didn't have enough guidance for how to safely reopen schools. Was he looking for that guidance from the federal government?
It wasn't terribly clear. I think mostly what he was saying was that there's no right way to do this yet. I don't know if he expected the federal government to have some idea of how to safely reopen schools, but his explanation was that the state certainly doesn't have it within them right now to say, oh, this is how you reorganize a classroom. This is how you do lunch. This is how you bus kids to and from school. These are all examples the governor used as to why it's going to be very, very difficult to get kids back in those classrooms, even for the last few weeks of the school year, in order to set them up for the summer and for next year. That was the intention, but it looks like that goal is now being put off until the fall at the earliest, because it's just too hard to keep not only the children safe from being vectors of spreading the disease, but also staff and teachers and everyone that comes in contact with them. It was just going to be too much of a logistical problem to do it safely. And if it can't be done safely, the governor says it shouldn't be done.
That's WCAI State House reporter Mike Dean checking in, as he does most weeks. Mike, thank you.
Thank you.
And that was WCAI's Catherine Iden speaking with Mike Dean up at the State House. This was the week when some local nursing homes saw a surge in the number of COVID cases. On the front lines at those homes are people who are often doing grueling work while being paid very little. They're certified nursing assistants. WCAI's Jeanette Barnes joins us to talk about doing that job while facing COVID-19. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve. Good morning.
Jeanette, when you think about what has to happen daily at a nursing home, whether it's dressing people, oftentimes showering them, or helping them to go to the bathroom, it's tremendous work. And now you add on to it the risk of COVID-19. You talked to someone about this week who gave you some insight. Tell us what they said, who they were, and what they said.
Yes. So that's Lori Porter, and she is the head of a national interest group for CNAs. It's based in Missouri. We talked about what's happening in the nursing home. She said many times they have not been prioritized for PPE, or that the large companies that own hospitals are buying up large amounts of PPE, and it's harder for nursing homes to get it.
Those are the protective gear, the gowns and the masks.
Right. Yeah, sorry. So in some cases, she says CNAs are being asked to reuse the same mask for a week. And this is already in the kind of on top of a situation where, at least from their point of view, there are not enough CNAs staffing many of the facilities. She says she got a call from a CNA in Indiana this week who was caring for 35 patients by herself. Mm. And Lori Porter from the CNA Association, she said that it's true when CNAs respond to infection control surveys that they are not reporting enough hand washing. And it's because, she says, they're going from one emergency to the next. That just falling off a toilet is a serious risk of death for a nursing home patient. And sometimes they're just, you know, just triaging crisis after crisis. And that, of course, is for that average wage of $13 an hour, she says.
Mm.
If they work 40 hours year round, that's only $27,000.
And that means that many of them are holding more than one job.
Right. So they do go to more than one job. Sometimes they are working for agencies that send them to more than one location, although she said there is a serious damper has been put on doing that because of the risk of transferring it from patient to patient. So in a lot of cases now they're being limited to one location. yep.
In an entirely different conversation this week, you spoke with a young woman from the Cape who's a nursing student at Mass General in Boston, who spoke about her experiences working in a hospital in the midst of the pandemic. Such a powerful story. Tell us a little bit about what you heard there.
Yes, so she is a nursing student working as a nursing assistant at MGH, and she's in her early 20s. She talked about how isolating it is for the staff because they need to, in many cases, not interact with their families. They're trying to isolate themselves at home, either in hotels. They're allowed to go to a hotel if they need to. She lives alone, so she's going home, but she hasn't seen her family or friends. It's very emotional for the nurses. A lot of times they're standing in for the families as patients are either gravely ill or in some cases passing away. She says it feels kind of like a war zone because patients come in scared and because they don't know if they'll be able to see their families. And they ask her, am I going to get better? And she really doesn't have an answer.
Mm. That story, along with the nursing home story, are on the website. Folks can go and take a look at them, capeandislands.org. Jeanette Barnes, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Steve.
That is our show for today. I want to thank my guests. We heard from WCAI's Sam Houghton, Eve Zuckoff, and Jeanette Barnes. We spoke with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Alex Darris at the Provincetown Banner. We checked in with Ethan Genter at the Cape Cod Times and Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We heard from Noah Asmo at the Vineyard Gazette and Mike Dean up at the State House speaking with Catherine Eidend. And a big thanks to Dan Treidel back at the studio, who is ever on his toes for when things go a bit sideways. A lot of behind-the-scenes technical magic happening to bring you the program these days. And thanks to my family for mostly playing quietly while we're on the air. From my home in Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.